When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 17th of September 2025, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, reviewing some of the top construction industry stories from the past couple of weeks. And I must apologise in advance to listeners if I dry up or lose my voice completely, but I seem to be brought down with a dose of COVID, which has coincided with a holiday. So I've got both COVID and a holiday, which is great.
Well, you look like you're in the world's poshest hospital, David.
Yeah. I am in very pleasant surroundings in the south of France. But anyway, yes, so I haven't really been paying attention to the news over the last couple of weeks, Phil. But there's been a lot of politics going on, I understand.
Well, the biggest story since we last spoke was the resignation of the Deputy Prime Minister and Housing Secretary, Angela Rayner, for underpaying the amount of stamp duty that was due on her flat in Hove that she's bought. And I'm afraid I rather side with, Matthew Paris in The Times wrote, I think it was this morning or Wednesday morning or Tuesday morning this week, that he thought that she didn't have to go. You know, Starmer could have rode it out. And he also said he didn't think that, another big story, but nothing to do with us, is the ousting of, or the withdrawal of Peter Mandelson as the US ambassador, and all adding up to stuff that Starmer and the government don't want, don't need. And Matthew Paris, Times commentator, former Tory MP of some renown, well, was a Tory MP of any renown, really, but he's a commentator of some renown.
Yeah,
saying that he could have, you know, bashed it out and kept them on. But anyway,
I think either way, it wouldn't have looked good. Anyway, I mean, Mandelson's a serial wrong-un, isn't he? I mean, he can't hold down a job. He gets sacked as soon as he's given a government post.
I think he just has too colourful a life with colourful friends.
Yes, I think that's probably true. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Angela Rayner, who, I mean, I'm sad to see her go because she was.
Yeah, I thought she was pretty good.
She brought colour and energy and vigour.
Yeah.
And as the report, I mean, the whatever it is, the standards, independent standards commission or whatever it is, who finally said the report and said she failed to uphold the very highest standards by getting her tax liabilities wrong. But 99% of us do exactly the same thing. You go to your conveyancing solicitor and your estate agent or whatever whoever you go to normally to buy a house, say, what do I need to pay? It says, where's the stamp duty? Say, okay, I'll do that. And it wouldn't occur to me to sort of go to some top barrister and, you know, pay money to get a second and a third opinion to double check. Are we sure? Are we sure I've paid the right, you know, done everything right here? But clearly when you're Deputy Prime Minister and Secretary of State for Housing, there is a strong body of opinion that says not allowed to make that sort of mistake.
No, you've got to be squeaky clean. I agree that I thought Angela Rayner was dealt with fairly harshly here. I don't know whether she had to go or not, but I think that she hadn't really committed an awful sin. Her departure was just came a couple of weeks after the homelessness minister, a woman called, I'd never heard of her before, Rushanara Ali. I think she's an MP in East London. She resigned for something which I thought was far more hypocritical and
yes, I agree.
Far more reprehensible, which was she was the minister for homelessness. She had a rental property, at least one rental property in East London. She gave her tenants notice to quit and then put the property back on the market at £700 a month more than the previous tenants had been paying.
Isn't this exactly the thing which the legislation she was putting through Parliament is going to outlaw?
Yes. Exactly, yes. So I think, you know, there wasn't, I mean, maybe because she was a junior minister, she wasn't a, you know, a cabinet secretary. Maybe the You know, the spotlight wasn't on her quite so much as it was. But you compare that with Angela Rayner's, let's call it a mistake. I think Angela Rayner was didn't really deserve the same sort of treatment, put it that way.
And she clearly has, again, in defense of Angela Rayner, her private life does sound extraordinarily complicated. And
yeah,
the issue of whether it's a second home or not is because it was deemed to be a second home because she is a trustee of a trust in the name of her disabled son. So she doesn't actually own the first house, but she has some liability towards it as a trustee. So all of that, it's not, you know, it's not cut and dried. It's not, oops, I forgot it was my second house. I should have paid more stamp.
Easy to make a mistake, I should think, under those circumstances.
She clearly doesn't or didn't consider that she was the owner of that house because it had been sold to a trust. Anyway.
But anyway,
she's gone. And the person who comes in is Steve Reed, who moves over from Department for, is it called the Department of the Environment, which is basically the guy who's trying to sort out the water industry. And I heard, I think I mentioned before, I listened to the Ed Ball's George Osborne podcast, because I got fed up listening to Alistair Campbell and the other guy being too self-righteous. I think, you know, the Balls and Osborne are a little bit more human beings, I think. And Ed Balls was saying, had to check quite carefully, because his wife, Yvette Cooper, is central to the reshuffle, having been moved from Home Office to Foreign Office. But he's basically making the point that an awful lot of people have been moved have just been in office a year. They've just finally, you know, started to get to grips with things and starting to make a mark and starting to, you know, put plans down. And particularly Stephen Reed, the done this big Ofwat review, and it's all starting to happen. And now all change and everything's going to grind to a halt again for whatever, probably, you know, several months while the new person gets to grips with things. And Stephen Reed's got an awful lot on his plate. I mean, I think Angela Rayner, in some ways, will be quite glad that she's not going to have to carry the can for the broken promise of 1.5 million houses by 2029 or 2030 or whatever it is. And I strongly suspect Stephen Reed won't either, because we'll probably have a third, fourth and fifth housing secretary by the time the next election comes.
A few years before we get there,
If path forms anything to go by. And we talked last met a couple of weeks ago, David, about the blockages in housing, in house building, I should say. We talked about the building safety regulator and Gateway 2 and all of these sort of things. And planning reform is on its way, but it takes time. There was interesting stat from, where is it from? Home Builders Federation. Home Builders Federation have been very busy, actually.
They've
come up with the housing pipeline. I think I mentioned their spring pipeline last time we spoke. And since then, a new revised pipeline has come out, quarterly assessment of what's happening. Headline is planning permission for new homes in England during the second quarter of this year were down 17% year on year. So in the first quarter of this year, 44,500 new homes. So multiply that by four and you get, what do you get, about 180? Is my math right there?
4 fours are 16,
So, assuming it stays at that, 180, actually it's 45, rather, 180,000 new homes in England. Okay, we're talking about the UK, England rather than the whole of the UK. But actually, when it comes to the housing stats, England is, I don't know exactly, but it's something like 90% of the total. I mean, it strongly dominates the numbers. And that 180,000 planning permissions is a long way short of the 250 that need to be built every year. And that's just permissions. As we know, not all permissions get built out. So it's pretty grim. We've got the sites approved are down. That was housing units at 44,500.
Yeah.
Sites approved 1,400 in the second quarter, the 10th successive quarter of decline. And in the 12 months to June, just 8,200 sites. So in other words, the stats are showing planning permissions, planning approvals are in decline.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very, as ever, you know, the graphics illustrate it really well. There's a graph that you've reproduced on the story as well from the HBF, which shows both the number of units and the number of projects which had got planning approvals. And it's a really steep and steady decline from the first quarter of 2021, when actually it peaked.
Well, there's a bit of a spike when we came out of COVID because of the sort of the...
Yes, the exactly.
The cork came out the bottle kind of thing. But it's been a downward trend.
Yeah, and this is despite all the... You know, when the Labour government came in last year, they were going to get rid of all the obstacles, you know, the bats and the newts and all the rest
of it. They're doing that. The legislation came through, but it takes time. It takes time. They can't do it at a click of a finger.
Yeah, they can't do it overnight, yeah. But, it needs to happen soon then, because, I mean, things are slowing down quite severely.
But the new pipeline, updated pipeline, I should say, from the Home Builders Federation, that came on out on the 8th of September, 9 days ago. And then just at the beginning of this week, the same organisation brought out a new report specifically looking at London called Mind the Gap, which is basically a lobby document saying that, revealing how bad the slowdown in house building in London is. And a lot of that we talked last time, a building safety regulator, but it's more than that. It's the, as being well documented, the amount you need to earn to get even put down a deposit is huge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got some of the numbers here. I mean, the house price to earnings ratio in London is 11. So basically, the average price of a house in London is 11 times the average salary.
Compared to 7.7 nationally. Yes, I've found where you are now. The average cost.
And the average cost of first home is now 17 times the net annual salary of a 22 to 29 year old. Well, I've got offspring in that age bracket. And I can tell you, they know that very well, because they say we'll never own a house because we just can't afford to keep up.
Because when I bought my first property, or jointly bought it in the 1980s, it was just starting to realize, I think I was able to get a mortgage of three times my salary. And that was, and then they moved that up to four times, I think, the salary at one point when they stopped having big generous deposits. So, yes, the idea of mortgage three times your salary will get you a small flat somewhere, or a bed sit, is certainly in London, and if anywhere, doesn't cut it.
No, absolutely.
So a big ask from the home builders is reinstatement of some kind of Help to Buy scheme. But the criticism of that, and the Tories had quite a generous Help to Buy scheme, and all it seemed to do, I mean, yes, some people bought, but the house builders just made stonking great big profits.
Yeah.
And that sounded like, they're getting rich at the expense of the taxpayer. But at the same time, the bigger their profits, the more tax they pay. So there's this whole thing about, particularly a sort of a leftist political viewpoint, that somehow big profits are ugly and to be condoned. But of course, big profits mean big tax payments, corporation tax payments.
Yes, that's true. I don't know. I mean, I'm not very good at economics, Phil, but if the big house builders are lining their pockets, that's money which was sloshing around somewhere, but it seems to have accumulated in their bank accounts. That's the way I see it.
No, they're reinvesting it. They're spending the money they get their shareholders are doing well, but it's what is it? A rising tide floats all boats. So, if the big house builders are doing well, they've got a bigger workforce who are earning more money, who are, going down the pub more and filling up their supermarket trolleys more and whatever. Just economic growth results from it. So, we all got a little bit turned off when the Persimmon chief executive some years ago took a, £75 million bonus. There is such a thing as taking the piss, if producer Tom is not going to bleep that out. but as long as they don't take the piss, I think we shouldn't get too upset about big profits.
Business is business.
Economic motors of, companies who are powering the economy. Anyway, you say, moving swiftly on, you say you're not good at economics. I tell you, I am absolutely not good at economics. I sent a question, same question, to two of the construction industry's most respected and high-profile economists. David Crothwaite, the chief economist at the Building Cost Information Service.
Yes, old friend of this podcast.
Friend of the pod. And Noble Francis of the Construction Products Association. He's also a professor of construction economics at the Bartlett School of Sustainable Construction. And we tried to get Noble Francis on, but the waiting list to get him on a podcast is still way down the list to get him on. But the question I asked both of these people was, why is it that the monthly PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, which we report every month, first Friday or the 5th of every month, around that, why is it the monthly PMI insists that UK construction activity has shrunk every month so far this year, up until the 4th of September, the August PMI came out, 45.5 for August. Anything below 50 means it's shrinking. A little bit better than the 44.3 reading in July, but still shrinking, but shrinking less bad. I got a bizarre comment from someone who thought they were a constructionist economist saying, well, the construction has grown in August because it's grown from 44.3 to 45.5, and I had to write back and say, I think you've got this wrong, mate. It hasn't grown, it just
hasn't shrunk as fast.
It's the rate of acceleration has slowed, or deceleration has increased. It's still in negative territory, and it has been every month this year. So why is it the monthly PMI, back to my question, why is the monthly PMI showing construction activity has shrunk every month so far this year? But the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, says that output is growing. Although ONS is just GB, it doesn't include Northern Ireland, but for the sake of this conversation, I don't think what's happening in Northern Ireland is going to hugely shift the balance of the wider UK figures. So let's pretend they're the same, they're measuring the same sort of thing. And the ONS said that construction output in Great Britain grew by 0.2% in July, following a rise of 0.3% in June. Now that's not tremendous. I mean that's very, very, very sluggish growth. But it's also growth. It's positive, whereas PMI is very clearly negative. Over the 3 months to July, output grew by 0.6%, according to the ONS, with new work up by 1% and repair and maintenance down by 0.1%. Mm. So generally, in July as well, it's new work that's growing and repair and maintenance flat. So new work is better than repair and maintenance at the moment, generally. So can they both be right? One is based on a survey of sentiment. The PMI has got a panel of people and they say, you know, lick your finger, stick it in the air, and how does it feel kind of thing. Are you basically...
Do we know how many people are in that sample?
I don't. I don't think it's huge. I don't know.
No.
But it's essentially not statistical. It's broadly a sentiment thing. Yeah. Whereas the ONS is statistics drawn from organisations, drawn from business returns, as I'll come on to explain. So the ONS ought to be much more reliable. It's the official, Office of National Statistics, their official statistics. We only know years later. They keep revising. Every time they bring out new statistics, they say, oh, by the way, we've changed our mind about last quarter after, they only have estimates for a period of time. Now, at risk of sounding, just reading things out, I think it is worth reading out the answers that we got from the two economists to try and explain what is going on. Because as you and I readily admit, David, we're clueless.
Yes, exactly.
Is construction growing or is it shrinking?
But do you know what? Just to pause at that point there. I'm glad you asked that question because I've always been too embarrassed to ask that question. I mean, I see these...
I have no shame.
I see these press releases come in and there's the ONS saying, oh, yeah, growth is continuing for the, you know, third quarter in a row. And then you get the PMI coming in and it's all doom and gloom. And I've just been too embarrassed to ask, you know, who's telling the truth here? So what do these economists say? Have they cleared it up for us?
Well, I think so. David Crothwaite from the Building Cost Information Service, he said, good question. They are both measuring different things, is the short answer. The PMI is a sentiment survey, brackets, a balance of responses approach, based on respondents' views of current market conditions, whereas the ONS output survey purports to measure firms' actual output in monetary terms in data provided by survey returns.
Okay.
In my opinion, both have their value. I tend to view the PMI as an indicator of current conditions, while the ONS data is more about is more of a historic view, i.e. what's gone before in terms of actual output, given the lag in collecting and producing the statistics.
Yeah.
Obviously, the samples for both surveys are fundamentally different. The PMI survey is relatively small in comparison to the ONS output survey and tends to focus on larger firms, whereas the output survey theoretically covers all firm sizes, including smaller firms, covered by the Interdepartmental Business Register. So attempts to provide a sector view, and given that construction is dominated, by a large number of small firms, that difference is quite important. In other words, yeah. PMI is biased towards big construction, whereas ONS is more representative of the whole industry because the whole industry is lots and lots of diddly firms.
And they all have to, we had somebody from the ONS on the podcast, didn't we, a while ago, and contractors have to fill in these forms. They have to respond to this request for data, don't they?
That's so right, yes. That's a legal requirement.
So presumably an awful lot of data flowing in every month.
Before I come on to Noble Francis' response to the question, David Crossway has a payoff line. It's interesting that the PMI survey is being picked up quite extensively in press coverage, much more than it used to be historically, and I suspect that it might be because it's painting a rather pessimistic view currently. In other words, journalists like bad news.
Yes, of course, absolutely. Yeah, he's put his finger on the button there.
So here's what Noble Francis says. And I should say, I didn't warn them that I was going to read out their answers. So they were just sort of, you know, dashed off in an email response. So any succinctness of prose, I should say, is due to the medium, not the message. Anyway, Noble Francis, as it happens, both the PMI and ONS construction output data have issues. The PMI is a quick, small sample survey done towards the end of the month, so it's largely tracking sentiment from purchasing managers at contractors. Sentiment in the economy and government has fallen away significantly since the autumn budget, and sentiment in business, some construction sectors, and in particular house building, has fallen away since March-April time. Now, here it gets complicated. This is me talking, not Noble. Back to Noble's response. The ONS, on the other hand, has its own issues. Without getting into too much detail, be cautious using ONS construction output data, because the ONS appears to have been overestimating output since 2022. The problems appear to affect all sectors, but especially RMI, repair, maintenance and improvement. The problems appear for two reasons. It appears to underestimate costs, so when removing price from its value data, it overestimates volume. Also, and here I get a bit lost, also, it may have survivor bias in its contractor survey when grossing up to the whole industry due to a rise in insolvencies. In other words, companies that go bust aren't included in the numbers.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Note, ONS suspended its materials price and construction price indices in March 2025 due to reliability concerns. Year-to-date construction output was 1.8% higher than a year ago, which is in line with the forecast of 1.9% in 2025. By in line with the forecast, that is, I think, the CPA's, the Construction Product Association summer forecast. Which is often regarded as the most reliable or the most listened to construction industry survey from the product manufacturers. So year-to-date construction output was 1.8% higher than a year ago, which is in line with the CPA forecast of 1.9% in 2025. However, given the serious problems in the ONS construction output data, our forecast being on track for this year means very little. The ONS construction output problem since 2022 are most evident in private housing RMI, the second largest sector, as highlighted in previous updates, and the problems in the data appear to be growing. According to the ONS, private housing RMI output in March 2024 was 61.4% higher than in January 2020. January 2020, remember, was the month when we first started hearing about Wuhan flu. Before any lockdowns or anything like that. So you would imagine it was the last sort of pre-COVID peak sort of thing. So according to the ONS, private housing RMI output in March 2024 was 61.4% higher than in January 2020. And more recently, according to the ONS, private housing RMI output in July 2025 was 8% higher than in March. Clearly, this is not in line at all with what builders, merchants, distributors or small contractors that are in the private housing RMI sector, what they're saying, what they're reporting. He doesn't mention it, but a survey I absolutely like is the Builders Merchant Index, Building Index.
Oh, yes.
Because that's point of sale data. It's, you know, stuff that goes through the tills at builders merchants. That is you know, very much measuring the RMI sector most accurately. It's not filling in returns or anything like that. Simply saying, how much stuff have you sold? The only googly with that is they talk about volumes of stuff and revenue generated, the takings, till takings. And I think it's the takings are sort of more interesting, but it depends how much building materials have gone up in price or gone down in price. But anyway, I think the building materials index thing is quite a good one. And I can't remember what that said lately. Let's have a quick look. I think it's on the rebound, the BMBI. Yeah, May, June. Was June the last one? There's a bit of a lag. Yeah, second quarter of 2025, builders merchants sold 4% more stuff and their takings were up 2.8% year on year. So that's it's not storming, but it's a proper solid increase. So
that does
suggest that RMI is on the up, whereas ONS has just said it's flat, basically. So, again, who knows?
Hmm. I think you've actually queried the reliability of ONS data in the past. This was even before we had somebody from the ONS on the podcast, because there's been this anomaly before. We've noticed this on the construction index that the ONS is sort of talking up the industry while everybody else is, you know, issuing warnings left, right, and centre. So it's interesting to hear somebody like Noble Francis, who, you know, clearly has
finger on the pulse.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, pointing out some of these problems, these sort of chronic problems with their data.
Yes. Anyway, the bottom line is, if you're busier, well done you.
Yes, exactly.
And if you're not, work harder.
Yeah. In a nutshell.
That's all I can say. I don't know whether we've cast any light on that at all for people, but lies, damn lies and statistics.
Right. Okay. Is that enough economics, Phil?
I think so.
It's beginning to swim.
I think we'll keep this a shorter than usual episode, so you can get back to your sick bed. But the final thing I just wanted to give a slightly more than passing mention. I got an email from someone who preferred to stay anonymous, saying train drivers at Hinkley Point C have been given notice of redundancies. 30 drivers need to leave as part of the project is completed. It's been a hard 2 weeks for all concerned. Now, obviously, losing your job is never a good thing. So I thought, well, if part of the job is completed, that's what happens. And when a job finishes...
Yeah, there's no more work.
There's no more work. And you go on, you move on to another job. That's the nature of the industry we're in, certainly on the contracting side. But I thought, well, I'll just get a statement from bylaw. There might be a story in it. A bylaw being the Bouygues Lang O'Rourke joint venture, the main civils contractor. And they said, as work on Hinkley Point C progresses, the needs for plant and skills on the project evolve. Of course they do. The number of workers on site has been changing for years, depending on the project phases and the expertise required, and we've planned for our current phasing. As always, we'll work with anyone impacted by project phasing to ensure they're supported through the process. So it sounds like to me, all very sensitively. Then I got a follow-up email. I said to my anonymous correspondent, thanks for this. I'll put the questions to Brig Langer bylaw and see what they say. And he said, I also asked him, was there, a union person I should contact who sort of speaks for the crane drivers to get a line from
well,
there?
Well, I asked
the anonymous correspondent whether there was a union person I should be talking to get some sort of line on from the, speaking for the labour force rather than just some, potentially aggrieved individual or whatever. And he said, no, we have a union, but they can't do much for us. They got so much work on. And he goes on to say, well, there's not a lot of representation there. But the point system, it says they're using some sort of point system, the employers for the crane drivers, and it's stressing us all out. Drivers had to wait 2 weeks to learn their fate and to be told, oh, sorry, it's an admin error, you shouldn't be here. And everyone's feeling the pressure. No one quite knows what's going on. Some drivers haven't slept for 2 weeks. Go in, suddenly find they're being made redundant, and apparently there appears to be a lot of turmoil and uncertainty. So that suggests that from the crane operators' point of view, it's not all being handled quite as smoothly as bylaw statements suggest. But I can imagine it is ever thus. I mean, people losing their jobs never think, oh, well, that's okay then, that's fine, I've been well handled. You're always going to feel stressed and not know, what's going to happen. Can I pay the mortgage? Where am I going? Do I have to move house to the next job? What's going on? And I think what makes it particularly bad is that the crane operators were supposed to be long gone from Hinkley Point C. The project was all supposed to be, when construction started in 2017.
It was supposed to be finished.
Supposed to be finished and all, powering up and producing electricity by now.
So they've actually got more out of it than they should have done.
They've had 8 years there on site, or I don't know, maybe they weren't there from day one. I'm sure they weren't, but they've had more years there than they might have expected.
I'd be interested in knowing more about the sort of tenure of employment there. I mean, are they all self-employed contractors? Are they independent? I mean, he mentions a union rep. Which suggests that they're employees rather than independent contractors themselves. And crane operators, I should think, particularly on a job like this, get paid extremely well, don't they? The salary for a crane driver, I don't know what it is, but it's up there.
I think opportunity to earn is up there because of the overtime. I mean, I think they're pretty well paid. They're not tube drivers.
But that's in a different category.
But it's a good earner when you're working and good opportunity for overtime, things like that, yeah.
But if they're employees, then wouldn't they be moved to a new project? I mean, go over to the other side of the country and start working on Sizewell C, for example? Presumably they're not at the right phase yet.
No, it's a long time before the trains go up at Sizewell C, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
They just have to go where the work is. And
if there isn't always a
job straight to go to.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I just thought that was it. I sympathise with the crane drivers. I see no way around it apart from, maybe Brig Langer Orker being perhaps not quite as sensitive from the perspective of the employees or the freelance crane drivers, whatever they are, as they think they are.
Mm. Tell you what, I'd love to know how much the bloke operating Big Carl gets paid. World's biggest land-based crane,
But
must be queuing up to work on that.
He's probably got the most comfiest seat.
Yeah. But he's lifting several thousand tons a day. So there's a lot hanging on there.
He is not lifting 1,700. He's only done about 4 lifts or maybe 10 lifts. I'm sure whoever the operator is on that crane, it doesn't, I mean, when it lifts big, but it doesn't...
They probably fly them in from Dubai when they need to lift something.
It's not exactly duty cycle. Yeah, it's a bit like, the specialist, I don't know what sports they have it in, but there was a time in top class international hockey, and I'm talking proper hockey, field hockey here, you used to be able to have a short corner specialist who could be, as soon as you won a penalty corner, you could run on, smack the ball into the net, the specialist hitting the ball from a penalty corner and running off again. So whether the big Carl driver is like that, he runs onto the pitch, specialist moment and goes back
pulls
home,
the levers.
Or whether he's doing something else on site for the... Or she. Good Lord, big sexist.
Indeed, indeed, yes.
But you need, yeah, you're looking worse by the minute, David. You shouldn't be here.
Well, I think I'll go and grab some medicine and sit by the pool for a while.
Don't fall in.
No, I won't.
Okay, well, get well, look after yourself, and
thank you very much.
Try and enjoy the rest of your holiday, and yes, we'll speak again in 2 weeks' time. But for everyone listening, I hope we haven't confused you more than you even were about economics and surveys and whether the construction industry is growing or not. I attempt to shed light. We don't have answers. We really only have questions. I think we said before, but we do our best. Anyway, from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.